This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
The title of the book, Seven Rights for Citizen Slackers, with notes from the battles of Good King Boaz and the author, Dennis Boaz. He joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Lulu Publishing. Hello, Dennis.
Oh, hi, Steve.
Great to great to have you with us. We're going to have a lively discussion about human rights, citizen rights. You've got your very unique take on it, especially given all the following this very highly contested election and the presidential election. And you really, as you put it, you reread the Declaration of Independence, and what jumped out at you?
Well, what jumped out at me was that it was the intent of our revolutionaries to have a government whose purpose was to secure the rights of people. In fact, that's what they believed governments were. They, in the Declaration, in the second paragraph, which is where all the heavy stuff is found, it says governments are initiated to secure the rights of the people. Some other words in there, and it says, and when those rights, when a government is destructive of those rights, it's the right the people to alter or abolish the form of government, which in this case is the Constitution. And frankly, I no need to abolish the Constitution. We can amend it into any form we want to, given enough time. As long as it, to me, eventually gets back to the point that government is established to secure the people's rights. And that didn't happen. In the Constitution, 11 years after the Declaration, you can look at the preamble and you can see the rights there are national rights, and the individual rights are thrown at the back of the bus. So my premise is that we got started off in the wrong foot with the Constitution, which is a document which organizes the powers of government. That's the purpose of it. And the human rights are thrown in at the end, and there are only some of those. There's some social rights, but where are the educational, cultural, safety rights? They're not there. So we didn't start our government based on human rights, and I think if we had, or if we do some point in the future, then we'll be able to achieve the purpose of government, which is to secure the rights of the people, and that's all the rights of the people. I mean, if you just secured some of the rights of the people, you'd have an imbalanced government, and that's what we have now. We just secure some of the rights of people, and so we're just limping along as a government and as a society, because those a full body of rights was never taught to us, and I believe that I discovered and developed a full, complete body of balanced and comprehensive rights that'll make the lives of people in our country and potentially everywhere better.
So do you
more remarkable.
So do you see the Democrat Party or the Republican Party really representing the people today, their rights or their desires?
No, I don't. You know, it's they're into one of the rights, and that's the rights of the people to have power. As I see it, that's one of the seven rights, and we manifest that through democracy. We don't have a representative democracy. You know, I won't insist on a pure democracy. Too many people, but we don't have a meaningful representative democracy. Because we have private money and public elections, and we have an electoral college which prevents each person from having one vote. And the electoral college, of course, is anti-democratic. We don't even have the right to democracy in the Constitution. You know, it's found in the Declaration of Independence. Eight rights are found in the Declaration of Independence, and none of those are found in the Constitution. Isn't that kind of strange? I guess they decided they couldn't really achieve the rights of the people, so why put them in the Constitution?
So your title says Seven Rights for Citizen Slackers. Now, tell us about your term citizen slackers. Who are they?
Well, they're all of us, actually. They are the citizens. I mean, if government was established to secure the rights of people, why did we only have one person, Madison, who tried to tell us what our rights were? And if you look at those rights, they're mostly defenses against abuses of the British colonial government. So they're social rights in terms of how we punish people, right, and what our rights are when we're punished by a government. But there were no cultural rights. There are no educational rights. There aren't even any safety rights in there. And yet, you'll find that in the Declaration of Independence, those rights. So one of my premises is we need to include all the rights of the Declaration of Independence, because for some reason they were ignored. And the Ninth Amendment protects those rights because it says nothing in the enumeration of rights in the Constitution shall not be construed to demean or disparage others retained by the people. And in 1787, what rights did the people have? None other than the rights of the Declaration of Independence. And we have the right to change government according to our revolutionary founders, but when it takes two-thirds of the legislatures of the United States and then three-fourths of them are political conventions to ratify any amendments from a constitutional convention, that's hardly a right, at least in the Constitution. And yet, that's what we have to go through to amend the Constitution, because Congress is not going to amend the Constitution in any serious way. And we have several problems in the Constitution which prevent us from having a meaningful representative democracy. And so one amendment at a time won't do it. We need an Article 5 convention. And that's where the citizen slackers, that's us. Whereas if we, more of us, get involved, we can change this and establish our government so that it's more balanced and so that the resources of government are apportioned more evenly across the board.
Well, that is the genius of our government, of citizen involvement. That is so critical, and most of us, you know, we vote, and like you point out, we pay taxes, and, you know, we, of course,
in
times of war, we go to war, but you're saying it's
more... fully informed. You know, and that's one of the five rights. I call it the right to truth. Some people would call it the right to know. It doesn't much matter. It's also the right to justice and fairness. But unless we're informed as to what's going on, we can't do our job. And you know, I didn't put it in my book, but frankly, I finished the book, the substance of it, in November of 2014, and it wasn't crucial to me to finish it just as the prior day's news events ended, because its premises are beyond the daily news.
So as you look at the presidential candidates that were vying to become president in this last campaign, Bernie and Hillary and Mr. Donald, any of them represent citizens?
Well, they all represent some citizens, right? I mean, Hillary won the popular election, and Donald won the election where it really counted. Again, you know, I've been harping on against the Electoral College since the 90s when I initiated a petition in Guam, which I call Guahan in deference to the Guamanians or Guahanians. They've changed the name of their island territory, but, you know, it takes a while for the cartographers to catch up. And pretty expensive, I imagine, to change all the maps in the world for one little teeny tiny territory. But at least start that petition so they could vote in federal elections and vote for president. You know, they're Americans, but they can't vote for president, and they send their daughters and sons off to be killed in our various conflicts, and it's unfair. And at the same time, so that the votes of Guahanians would matter, I also had that petition was to abolish the Electoral College so they could have a vote that was meaningful. And frankly, look at California, where I, as a Californian, voted, and the the votes didn't matter, you know. I mean, we didn't get the candidates coming out here except for money and to speak with their friends who had money. But we Californians were kind of ignored in the election. But in terms of people, in terms of demographics, Bernie touched the millennials more than any other candidate. And he's very progressive, and except for his protectionism, I don't agree with the protectionism element that came into it, because that seems to fly in the face of the innovation we do in this country, which, you know, says that we need to keep our jobs as they are. Well, technology is changing things too fast. If Bernie had said, we're all entitled to a lifetime continuing education so we can keep up with technology, then I think that would have been a more improved argument rather than just a right to education at public universities. I mean, most of the important education is going to be done on the internet, and there, of course, after the internet studies and the collaboration among groups of people. But it doesn't have to be all brick and mortar education to get a good education anymore. And that's what people should have. I mean, if the people in the Rust Belt are willing to move, and if they had a right to a lifetime education, they could move anywhere where jobs were needed. And if we had an educational system that taught about our whole self, the mental, physical, emotional, and the creative, we would learn about our full potentials. And that's the problem with the teaching on human rights in this country, is they're not taught as human potentials. They're taught us how to defend ourselves against the abuses of government. That's about all students know about human rights. We realize they recognize our potential, our human potentials and our full range of human desires, then they would realize how shameful it is that we haven't gotten a full education so that we could achieve our full potentials. We are educated mostly left brain or mental and physical in school, and we ignore our emotional or psychological and our creative selves. So we get a half brain education. So what I have here, these seven rights for seven citizens, not only applies to government, but it could be applied in, and to change government would take much longer because we have to go through an Article 5 convention. But we could be changing education now, and through our charter schools, and eventually to our general public schools, if it were to ever catch hold. And we could change the corporate structure of our businesses by basing salaries along seven levels of consciousness or rights. I have a corporate system that reduces the difference, the wage inequality difference, and does a lot of other things for the workers that the current corporations don't do. I mean, if you base your corporations on attaining the rights of the workers and the instead of the profits of the shareholders, you really have a different outlook on business. And I believe this kind of business could outcompete typical corporations, because I think that the typical corporations are too top-heavy in terms of salary to upper management.
Your education goes all the way back to the Berkeley New Age sojourn, as you put it, and back in the 70s. So a foundation was built there, as you put it,
yeah.
As you called them, ancient raw origins of a comprehensive body of rights.
Right. Well, okay. Let's start with the chakras of the Upanishads. The chakras, seven chakras, represent. I studied for a couple of years with a writer and a Hindu tantric and a philosopher, and he taught the chakras as levels of consciousness and levels of desire. And because he says that he used to say, he's deceased now, he would say that everything we're conscious of, we want to have, touch, feel, love, control. In other words, we want it. We're curious about it. We want to eat outer space. We want to know about it. We want to do it. everything that's there, we want to know something about in our reality, and so it, that's what the chakras were, or at least in the way they're modernly interpreted, is that they're levels of consciousness, and they include everything, but they're linear. I studied the Egyptian tarot, and I studied with a social anthropologist. I took 6 months of detailed instruction on the symbols of the Egyptian tarot, and that's where I learned that there are four, that we are, the way the Egyptians defined us, and I agree with it, humans are fourfold. We're mental, physical, emotional, intuitive, or intuitive/creative beings. And once you establish this, it's like these four elements are the playing field of life. We do things mentally, physically, emotionally, creatively. Then you have the foundation of the four, and on top of that, you have the seven chakras, which say that mentally we have seven levels of consciousness, physically we have the same seven levels of consciousness, emotionally same seven levels. So those can be transferred into human rights, because human rights are fundamental desires. So you see, there is this connection between the Hindu chakras and levels of desire or levels of human rights. And so I just, in a sense, transliterated chakras and gave them English names that we can understand as rights. And it's really it's a four-sided, seven-leveled organizational system that ultimately, and I have graphics in the book, that can be understood by a citizen. And once it's understood what potentials are being denied by our educational system, I think we may have a movement towards a holistic educational system instead of the half-assed educational system we now have. And I say that as a credentialed teacher, having taught for 8 years high school, as well as having been a lawyer for more than 30 years. That's where my knowledge of basic human rights and my ability to read legal documents comes from.
Well, Dennis, we appreciate you sharing about your book, Seven Rights for Citizen Slackers. Dennis Boaz is the author, and of course the publisher is Lulu. Tell us the best way to get your book, Dennis.
Amazon, Lulu, Barnes & Noble, you know, it's ebook, and I've made it very affordable. I believe I have a blueprint for societal transformation that can be very enduring. I've made it affordable. An ebook is it's an affordable private. Down at the bottom for ebooks. I don't know whether I should say the price or not, but. If you can't afford a paperback, then you can afford an ebook. And I think it's important to read. It will help change the perspective of citizens and get them more involved. And I frankly want all citizen slackers to become citizen partners, because I believe the social contract is no longer just between citizens and their government. I believe it's among citizens, among each other, and that we have a right and duty to secure and encourage these rights for one another. That's my philosophy.
Well, thank you, Dennis, for being with us.
You bet, Steve. My pleasure.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors, all quilters just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff. And find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Left Shift, How and Why America is Heading to Second-Rate Single-Payer Healthcare. And the author is Dr. David Armstrong. And Dr. Armstrong joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. And this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Doctor.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you with us. When we think about healthcare, of course, Obamacare, that's been in the news so much for so long, and now with a new administration talking about replacing it and all that. But we hear healthcare today, and we often hear the words, as you point out in your book, universal coverage, nationalized healthcare, socialized medicine. It sounds so good, free medicine, free medical care. But you've worked in both worlds, in Britain and now here in the United States. In Britain, how long have they had national health care?
So it was introduced in Britain in the 1940s after World War II. And prior to that, it was a diverse mix of private health care, voluntary organizations, some public health care. But post-World War II, as a political necessity, it was radically changed by a left-wing Labour government where the whole system was scrapped and a single-payer system was introduced.
And you worked in that for how long?
Almost 10 years.
So almost 10 years there, and now you practice here in the United States. So you've had, obviously, a very clear, practical, experienced understanding of both systems.
Indeed. I've had a front seat to how both systems work, to the positive aspects of both systems, to the negative aspects of both systems. And so I think I bring a unique perspective to the whole debate on healthcare delivery.
And when you think of British single-payer system, what's first thing that comes to your mind?
Well, first, the British public love it, because it is perceived as being free at the point of service. We all know nothing is for free.
Right.
And so it's paid for through taxpayer revenues. It's certainly available to all at the point of service. However, the costs are obviously much less, $3,000 per capita in Britain compared to over three times that in the U.S. But when you look at the results of a delivery system, which is basically socialized, single-payer, inexpensive, the results, for instance, deaths from breast cancer, colon cancer, heart attack, are much higher over there than compared to the United States with a quasi-private, public-private system.
Well, free sounds great, but nothing is ever free, as we've just pointed out. But at the same time, everybody can have access to it. But when it comes to someone suffering and dying in the family, it's a whole different perspective.
Indeed. So certainly people have access to it. But then that's when the complexities arrive, because the waiting list to see a physician is very high, and that is a hotly contended topic in the British newspapers. When you do get to see a surgeon or a specialist, the waiting list for surgery is months or even longer. And the waiting list that's published in the British press currently for people waiting to see a physician or have surgery is about 3.4 million people. So access is there for sure, but delivery on that quote-unquote free system is not as good as it sometimes is envisioned over here in the U.S.
Well, in one of your chapters, you talk about this waiting list, and you tell us about when you first discovered the waiting list. What it was a mind-altering experience.
It really was, and people were being put on this waiting list for years and years and years, classified by the kind of surgery that they needed and the urgency. Clearly, the cancers came first and were operated on as a priority. But the things like the gallbladders and the varicose veins and the hernias, they were simply put on a list and typically stayed there. And I remember as if it was yesterday, I pulled out these drawers with 2x3-inch index cards in them with names and addresses and phone numbers. And as I said in the book, I called these people, starting from the back, who had been on the list the longest, and 9 times out of 10, these people were no longer with us. And that was a very sobering experience.
So the waiting list was more like a library, not just a list.
Indeed. The British accept this. It's a cultural difference, and it's certainly a difference in expectations. So I think the typical British mentality is, well, you know, everybody's in the same boat. Nobody's getting priority treatment. And it's quote-unquote free, which obviously, as we said, it is not. And so this has historically been tolerated and accepted in the British public for the most part. The private sector is available, but obviously the private sector costs money. And historically, only about 10% of the British public make use of the private system.
Well, your first chapter gets right to the point, and the point is dealing with the death panel. So
right.
give us some overview on that.
So expectations in Britain are far different than they are in the U.S. For a litany of reasons. So if a loved one, for instance, is on death's door, there is less technology over in Britain to resuscitate them, to maintain them during a prolonged or even unsuccessful period of very, very, very ill health. And so the British public as a whole typically accept that we can't pour money, quote-unquote, down the drain. That's too harsh. But, you know, there has to be some expectation where care is withdrawn and the patient is just left to die. In the U.S., we have a greater expectations. And I have been there hundreds of times in the ICU when the patient is not doing well and it looks like things are not going to turn out. You turn to the family and you have that most difficult conversation saying, what do you want us to do? And the expectations are different. The cost of healthcare, 90% of the healthcare costs are in the last few years of life, being sucked up by these high-tech, invasive, life-sustaining procedures where, you know, perhaps we should call in a relatively new specialty called end-of-life specialists, which come to the family and they say, look, this is obviously a very sad time for you. We feel your grief. We're here with you, but we don't think this is really going to work, and we think we need to start weaning your loved one from all this major technology, healthcare sustaining efforts, sometimes to no avail, unfortunately. So the expectations are different. The availability of technology is a lot different. Obviously, we have much more invasive, life-sustaining technology in the U.S. than we do in the U.K. And it really sometimes is a kind of self-perpetuating system where the last years of life really absorb a disproportionate amount of healthcare funds.
It's great to have a healthcare card that gives some kind of, I guess, comfort and you know, to have to know that you're somehow insured, but at the same time, the society, the culture, as you pointed out, they've been so used to this for so long, it's just, well, that's the way it is when you live in Britain. But here, we expect something to happen right now. We go to the emergency room. We go, you know, everything is a right now kind of mentality.
Indeed. So ideal as it would be that everybody were to have health insurance and health coverage, I kind of view it as almost full employment. Clearly, we're at like 4.7% unemployment now. And I sometimes see parallels between the unemployment rate and the uninsured rate for the simple reason that the people without health insurance historically are young people who don't want to, you know, quote, waste their money on health care insurance because they're not going to need it because they're young and they're healthy and they're invulnerable. And these people don't feel like they should have to buy it. And obviously that was part of the pushback in the individual mandate under Obamacare. But when you look at the flip side in Britain, there are these 3.4 million people on the waiting list. And when you multiply that by six to account for the population differences, then we come to 20 million people, which is the number of individuals, quote unquote, uninsured in the U.S. prior to Obamacare. So there probably is no such thing as universal coverage or free for all or, you know, access is certainly there nominally or notionally in the National Health Service in Britain. But in practice, if there are 3.4 million people on a list, that's not really doing them much good. And when you translate the numbers, 3.4 million Britons is the equivalent of 20 million Americans. So it's kind of, it's ironic, it's strange how these numbers keep cropping up.
A lot of talk about replacing Obamacare. We're not sure where it's going, but even if it stays the same, what Obamacare has turned into is, even though everybody can get a card, but still because of the cost, because of the deductible, huge deductibles, it's not what it was told us that it was going to be like. So here we are again. We're always seem to be on the precipice of not a good return here.
Right. And it's ironic to see the kind of parallels that we see between Obamacare. Yes, notionally they have insurance. When it comes into practice, when it comes to implementing that insurance and getting health care, it's a similar pattern to Britain. Yes, they have coverage, but their names are put on a waiting list, as in 3.4 million people, and having to actually execute on this delivery of health care is sometimes obviously the most challenging aspect of health care delivery. It's fine having a plan to deliver it, and it's fine having socialized medicine and universal health care, but you know, if your name is just put on a waiting list or you can't afford the co-pays or the deductibles, it's all pie in the sky. The good thing in the U.S. is there, as far as the uninsured are concerned, there always has been access to health care. So there are laws out there, such as the COBRA law, which says if any person uninsured arrives at your hospital with a, say, for instance, a surgical emergency, that patient will be treated in your hospital at your cost, the same as any other patient if they had insurance. So that is to prevent hospitals shipping patients, uninsured patients, out to secondary or tertiary hospitals to kind of pass the parcel. So even though these individuals are technically uninsured, they are still protected by laws such as COBRA, which mandates the hospital to treat them.
Your book is 53,000 words long, but you say you can summarize it in three words. Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Don't do it, yes. Don't do it, America. Don't do it.
Having worked in both systems, what is clear is that, and one doesn't want to draw any parallels necessarily with big socialized organizations in the U.S., but I think we all understand when something comes under the government umbrella, and it is managed by bureaucrats and technocrats and government departments. Maybe these people are not as proactive as, for instance, in the private healthcare industry, which maybe are a little lighter, more versatile in getting the job done. So the problem that I saw in the National Health Service is this was a massive social program, which the cogs ground slowly, and sometimes they kind of fell off, and sometimes they ground to a halt. As opposed to in the U.S., where at least we still have a pretty diverse system of public, Medicare, Medicaid, of private, the Aetnas, the Humanas, all of the at least the remaining private healthcare insurers. And I think it's important that we maintain that diversity as best we can and for as long as we can, so that those people that feel like they want to spend more money, that have the ability to spend more money, can do that as a right without being forced into it, and yet we maintain that social safety net of the Medicares and the Medicaids and all the current social healthcare delivery programs that we have.
Well, we appreciate your firsthand experience and insight, Dr. Armstrong, in your book titled Left Shift: How and Why America is Heading to a Second-Rate Single-Payer Healthcare. What's the best way to get your book, Dr. Armstrong?
Either Amazon.com, where everybody gets everything, or Archway. It's available online as a hardback, paperback, or audio version.
Thank you so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
I appreciate your time, and you have a great day.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Archway Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Penance, and joining me from the Northeast in the United States of America is author T.C. Joseph. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Hi, Jay. How are you doing today?
Doing great. This is the third in a series. Your series falls under the subtitle of This Generation Series. This is book three. Penance is the name. Where did you come up with the passion to become an author?
You know, well, I think a boredom. Is the answer. I was controller of a very, very large multinational corporation out of New York. Briefly, I took an early retirement to take care of my mother, who had a massive stroke. So I've been doing daily care for her for the past 8 years. And I went from a fairly dynamic life, right? I mean, our business was so worldwide that in certain instances an earthquake would happen and I'd know it from our people in a nearby factory before it made the news.
Incredible.
So you felt like you really had your finger on the pulse of the world. And then I moved to a rural environment and I'm taking care of my mother, and I tended to miss that type of interaction. At the same time, There was this furor about December 21st, 2012. The end date of the Mayan calendar.
Right.
And I had been versed in Bible prophecy all my life. It's always been something that's been very interesting to me. But then I started to see what was going on with the world in terms of the Mayan calendar. And the Hopis have prophecies, time-specific prophecies that refer to the specific generation, as does Islam. And so I started wondering, what if these are all pointing toward the same events? They're looking at it from different perspectives, but what if they're pointing at the same events? And if so, then are they looking at this particular generation? That generation would be the one that was in play when Israel became a nation again. And from a biblical perspective, that's the time clock that sets end time prophecies.
Yes.
What other things were going on at the same time? 1948 was also when the government supposedly found a crashed spacecraft in Roswell, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Also when we dropped a nuclear bomb at the end of World War II. So we became capable of destroying the Earth actually only at that moment. So what has come out of this generation seems to be fulfilling a lot of prophecies. I'm Christian, so I lend to the Christian side of it. But other societies around the world have this inherent feeling, this feeling that something has got to give in the world. You know, there's an article in the press today about leaders of the large internet businesses, LinkedIn, Facebook, that people who are very powerful in these businesses have started to buy ammunition and power generators and homes in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this pervasive feeling that people have, not just in America, but around the world, that something has got to give.
As a student of Bible prophecy, that part of that effort or part of that notice is that the whole earth starts to kind of get in an uproar before the climatic events take place, if I understand it correctly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so this is what was happening in the books Precipice and Pentecost. What we did is we looked at three families who are bound by these ideas in different ways, right? Some from a Christian standpoint, some from a New World Order standpoint. They are in contact with alien entities, which and I explained previously in an interview that I took some information from a man named Nick Redfern, who was a researcher and writes interesting books, but he's kind of like Carl Kolchak, if anybody remembers the Night Stalker. He researches kind of obscure, maybe slightly occultish ideas or actions that are taking place.
Right.
Long story short, he was contacted by a think tank group within the United States government that told him that the government is, in fact, in touch with aliens after Roswell. But these aliens seem to have characteristics that remind the think tank group of demonic activity or demonic contact from the Middle Age literature. And so they think that the entities that the government is in contact with are extra-dimensional, not necessarily extraterrestrial. They provide the government with technology. And when they advised the government that they thought they were dealing with demonic entities hell-bent on the destruction of humanity, the government told them that they were well aware of the intent of the aliens, but they thought that they could manage that and still gain from the technology advice that was offered.
Incredible.
So that factors in as well. In the lives of the characters, because there's alien contact, but that alien contact seems to be malevolent.
And I will say this about your writing style and also your research. You are a curious person to incorporate all of those different genres together. Your books have been described as an audacious apocalyptic epic that fuses Christian myth and prophecy with science fiction elements. And also you've been described as a writer that blends the ideas and the concepts, or not the concepts, but the style of Dan Brown, Tim LaHaye, and Jerry Jenkins. The latter two are Christian authors. The first is a fictional author. Is that something that you were striving for in the writing of this series?
Yes, in a couple ways. I liked the Left Behind series, and it was written, again, you have to remember the time frame that it was written, and we can see more clearly now than we could then. But some of the things that bothered me about the Left Behind series are that the actions – or the things that take place from the Book of Revelation, from Daniel, from the prophecies in the Bible, were done. They took place supernaturally, so there was no explanation of how these events could occur.
Right.
But I find that God doesn't necessarily work that way. Often God works through natural agencies. And so I strove to find something, and that's why people will say sci-fi, something that is that is more concrete in how these events could occur. Still stay with the script of Revelation, still stay with the script of the Bible prophets. But there are actions that could happen. For instance, and this is where we move into penance, there's a lot of talk on the internet about a rogue planet in our solar system that comes into the inner solar system periodically and zooms back out. And if you listen to the people talk about this, they can kind of time it around certain Bible events, like the long day of Joshua, where the sun didn't set for 24 hours, but an invading entity coming through the solar system could so slow the Earth's rotation for the time that it was passing by the Earth that there could be a long day. So if you go through the Bible and look at this periodically, you can see that some of the events that are happening are really happening at God's hand, but there are things that have been set in place, right? I mean, that's the whole idea of Moed, right? It's the set times and places in the Bible.
So you have 350 pages. This must have been an enormous undertaking, I would think, in order to accomplish this. How long did it actually take to complete, and what is the significance of the title, Penance?
Okay. The Penance is kind of fun. The first two books were written actually as one large book, and it was my way of dealing with kind of the isolation of Elbrook here. And when I sent it to Archway, they said, you know, people just don't buy 700-800-page books anymore. So you got to break it down into two. And I did. And that became Penance and Pentecost. And I learned a lot from Archway in the editorial process. So Penance was my opportunity to start with a fresh piece of paper and craft a book from what I had learned. And it was, I thought, very exciting from that standpoint. It was daunting in a couple ways. One was that I lost a lot of the main characters at the end of Pentecost. And the ones that were left were people who kind of had a nefarious background. So I had to create somebody that we could get behind, right? And so the way that happened is that these people are realizing, some of them are realizing the error of their ways, and they're suffering real penance for the actions that they took. In particular, there's a character, Michael, who was a superior intellectual. I mean, the man just had incredible intellectual skills. But he channeled those into things they loved. One of them was archaeology, and the whole idea that there was an ancient race that had a technology or a level of civilization more advanced than what we have. And he finds evidence of this, and he uses that. He's a young priest. He uses that to create the myth. He actually fraudulently makes a Gospel of John that is earlier than any of the ones that we have in existence now, that shows that John did not actually view Jesus as divine. And so that colors everything, and it becomes a real card in the hand of the globalists. And so when we open Penance, he realizes that he was wrong. He's been misled, and he's been manipulated by this alien presence. And he gives his life to Christ, but he lives out his penance in book three.
You have a Christian background, and obviously it comes through in this novel, but it's not totally focused on Christian view. Is that correct, or is that a conclusion that you make?
It's correct. I think what I try to do here is, and this is where we get to the Dan Brown influence. Dan Brown's books were quite fun. But what they were really, really adept at doing was taking a fictional space where people's beliefs are suspended.
Right.
And in that space, planting doubts about the authenticity or the accuracy of biblical beliefs. And what I would like to do is do the opposite of that. So I'd like to have a book that appeals to more than students of Bible prophecy, people who are interested in the UFO phenomenon, people who are interested in the New Age movement, and kind of show how those different forms of thought kind of are subservient. They don't reach the level of inerrant supremacy that comes from Bible prophecy. But I, you know, I don't want to start with the premise that this is a book about Bible prophecy, because I think that that excludes too many readers.
And it is fictional, absolutely.
And the characters are tremendous fun, and it's eye-opening. It makes you think. You don't have to come away thinking the way I think, but at least it lays bare all these different worldviews. And as time progresses through these novels, we see that the worldview that really holds is the Christian worldview.
In writing this, what is the one event that you created that was either the most fun to create or the one that's going to startle or amaze your readers?
I think it is the beginning of penance. At the beginning of penance, there's a movement called the Dark Awakening, where millions of people around the world have been subject to satanic ritual abuse and have had multiple personalities infused into their being without them knowing it. And at the beginning of penance, they form an uprising worldwide that causes destruction and chaos, the likes of which we have not seen. The reason I find this to be very interesting is there's a man named Russ Dizdar who is, his job is deliverance ministry. And he's run into several, he would say hundreds of multiple personalities that have been induced in people with specifically this intent that at some point they will come about and create pandemonium. And so I borrowed that because this is his real life experience and what he's hearing from these people that he's brought deliverance to, and applying it to the very beginning of penance. So we can see this awakening of evil planted in the hearts of people.
I'm seeing a movie or maybe a television series on the horizon. What do you think?
Yes.
Here's
what I would love, because it's, I mean, I almost see this as a full season of television shows.
Right.
The characters are so much fun. And I would love that. I would love that because I think it broadens the audience and it gets people to think.
This is a wonderful book. Again, the title is Penance, and it's part of the Generation series. This is book 3. I'm sure there's more in the future. It sounds like you are not only curious, but fascinated and motivated to write and be an author. So thank you for joining me today and sharing the background story of Penance and the others in the series. Where do my listeners get a copy of your books?
I'll go to Amazon. Amazon.com and look for T.C. Joseph. The books are Precipice, Pentecost, and Penance.
The next one on the horizon, how soon will that be released? I'm guessing there is something.
I'm starting it probably next week. I left the main character in a torture chamber at the end of Penance, and I got to get him out of the box.
You got to get him out of the box.
Been weighing on my mind. So the next book will be Perugia.
Wow. Well, this is an exciting series, and I have a feeling that if things continue to go well for you, maybe we'll be looking for T.C. Joseph's books on in the marketplace and also in the theater and maybe on television. This is a great series, and I would recommend it to anyone that's listening. Thank you for joining me from Pennsylvania, joining me and sharing your story today.
Okay, thanks, buddy.
My pleasure. Again, listeners, you can find Mr. Joseph's books under his name, T initial, C initial, Joseph, and not only this book, Penance, but also the others in the series. For Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.